This is Maggie Jones in Natural Wonders. I'll be reading again from Eye of the Albatross by Carl Safina, but first I wanted to bring up a memory that I had. Years ago, I was listening to a call-in show about birds, and somebody called in and asked, what's the bird that says tweet? What's the one that says tweet? And that stumped both of the bird experts, and I'm back at home thinking, I know that one. It was the goldfinch. They say tweet. The goldfinches are nesting now. I don't think any songbirds nest later than the goldfinch. And they're entirely dependent on thistles and milkweed, as it says in allaboutbirds.org. They actually are strict vegetarians. Birds are the best seekers out of the high-quality protein that insects provide. Even big birds like eagles and hawks, they don't turn down an insect, a good insect. And the young of any birds need insect protein, except for goldfinches. They feed their young a diet of thistles, thistle seed. And if a cowbird sticks around long enough and lays an egg in a goldfinch's nest in July, the cowbird won't last long. The chick won't last long being fed on that diet. It'll die. Pretty interesting birds these goldfinches are. And looking at allaboutbirds.org, it says, paired up goldfinches make virtually identical flight calls. Goldfinches may be able to distinguish members of various pairs by these calls. The oldest known American goldfinch was 10 years, 9 months old when it was recaptured and re-released during a banding operation in Maryland. And they molt twice a year, which is unusual. They molt in spring. They molt that sort of drab coloration into their bright yellow, the males do. And then in the fall, they molt those bright golden colors and back into the drab tan color. So they molt once in late winter and again in late summer. And they are one of the wonderful signs of spring when you see the goldfinches at your feeder starting to molt into their gold color. But now back to the book, Eye of the Albatross, by Carl Safina. We're in the Western chain in the Hawaiian Islands, the most remote islands on Earth. We're on Tern Island in the French frigate Shoals. And the people there, the biologists there, have marked with satellite transmitters 10 birds, including Amelia, who Carl Safina is following closely. And I'm starting in the second chapter called Bonding. When Amelia stands for her next nest check, her egg is gone. Between her massive webbed feet sits a gray ball of spiky fluff. By this time, the 6th of February, many of the other albatross nests already harbor chicks. Amelia broods her baby 3 days, providing shade and shelter from heat and high winds. When her mate arrives to relieve her in the early morning of February 9, Dad immediately feeds the little chick, or tries to. He crouches so far forward toward the chick that his breast is touching the nest's low rim. The hungry chick is eager, pecking shakily at its parent's bill, peeping a shrill call that sounds like, me, me, me. Dad is trying so hard to begin regurgitating that the effort seems to force his wings partly open. At the same time, he's trying to make contact with the chick's little bill, but the uncoordinated hatchling keeps swinging away at the critical moment. Eventually, with the kind of persistence that precedes all earned rewards, the male practically swallows the chick's head. In the cavern of its father's gape, the chick opens its wobbly little bill. Dad squirts a concentrated stream of gooey, nutritious, liquefied oil into the chick's throat. Unlike most other birds, albatrosses and their tube-nosed relatives store oil extracted from their food. Albatross stomach oil is so energy-rich that its mean caloric value rates just below that of commercial diesel oil. After wiping its beak, the chick half stands and waves its little wings and then sits back down contentedly. For the moment, all's right with the world. And so a new phase kicks in. Amelia and her mate must now no longer simply share incubation shifts. The chick's arrival begins a period of increasing strain in an already strenuous life. Bodily reserves will be taxed to the max. Now food is the issue. Somewhere out on the sea, these birds are finding a food supply that is not at all obvious when you look at the surface of that vast ocean. But find it they do. Altogether, the seabirds of the northwestern Hawaiian Islands require an estimated 800 million pounds of prey annually, largely fishes, crustaceans, and squids. Perhaps 2/5 of the annual production of those animals in the ocean region. Of the amount consumed, albatrosses probably take half. Laysan and black-footed albatrosses eat mostly various species of squid, fishes, fish eggs, crustaceans, and anything else living or formerly living that they can hook their bills into. Albatrosses in general eat everything from small fishes to dead seabirds to squid to krill to gelatinous drifting tunicates to jellyfish, including the famously sting-infested Portuguese man-o-war. If they find a dead whale, their diet will include whale meat. Sometimes they feed on scraps of skin and blubber of whales killed by killer whales or by people. What they eat depends on where they happen to be and what they find. Many albatrosses follow ships because even kitchen scraps can make an albatross happy. They are inveterate scavengers and opportunists. When it comes to eating, albatrosses' motto seems to be better full than fussy. But in practice, almost all albatrosses almost everywhere eat mostly squid. It's even been suggested that albatross evolution and radiation around the world has corresponded to squid evolution as the birds become skilled squid finders. Squids are highly evolved, unusually successful predators in their own right. The Cretaceous mass extinction wiped out not only dinosaurs, but also many kinds of marine life that had flourished for an enormity of time. As the disappearance of dinosaurs opened the land to opportunities for birds and mammals, the extinction of marine faunas opened the seas to the radiation and proliferation of modern fishes and squids with new monarchies of predators. The rapidly spreading new jet propulsion bodied animals we know as squids evolved complex behavior, excellent eyesight, and surprising smarts. They've been called the soft intelligence and honorary vertebrates. Squids have proliferated into over 700 species, moving throughout the world's seas, from sunlit reefs to the black abyss, from the size of your little finger to the giant squid measuring almost 60 feet. Enter albatrosses. Albatrosses eat about 70 species of squid. At times, the birds catch them live and vigorous, but they also exploit the fact that many kinds of squid die en masse after spawning. About a day after dying in the chilly deep, the carcasses of many species of squid float to the surface, buoyed by increasing ammonia resulting from chemical changes in their livers. Albatrosses rely heavily on this phenomenon, which makes deep food available. In the western Tasman Sea, off New South Wales, Australia, a spectacular post-nuptial appearance of dead and dying 10-pound giant cuttlefish prompts a remarkable convergence of albatrosses. Birds from half a world away, from the South Atlantic, Indian Ocean, and New Zealand, find it worth their while each year to come for the funeral feast. In sum, albatrosses eat a lot of squid. People also eat a lot of squid, and fishing boats remove enormous quantities of the food albatrosses have for millennia relied on. In much of the world, squid fishing is done at night, using bright lights to attract squid to the boat, as moths are attracted to porch lights. So great is the fishing pressure now that the lights of squid fishing fleets are visible to astronauts in space, appearing like cities in the sea. With Dad now nest-bound, it's Amelia's turn to face the vicissitudes of the ocean, but she's an experienced pro. So far, she has survived all trials of weather, threats of starvation, and hazards of humanity. She launches herself from the runway and strikes immediately northward, Amelia sails past the island's shore, skims across the lagoon, and rises above the towering breakers beyond the reef, setting her course upon an open ocean, striking out into the wide trance of the sea. Belly to the sideways breeze, catching the wind for levitation, she climbs. Then turning her back to that same breeze, she uses the wind differently and adds gravity to accelerate her forward and downward toward the surface of the ocean. She brushes the water and shifts her body again, transferring the downward momentum to help lift her, exploiting the force of gravity to take her upward. Having used the wind to take her up, she uses it to take her down. Having used the gravity to take her down, she uses it to take her up. This gives her a smoothly undulating, rocking flight, each wing alternately pointing skyward, then pointing toward the water's surface, showing you now her dark back, now her bright belly. Wings fixed, she seems magically propelled. Only as you watch her nearing the vanishing point, only then do you begin seeing and feeling that these birds muster all their distance-eating achievement with their own effort and skilled exploitation of their exquisite design. Keep watching as she shrinks to a pinpoint, swooping up and down, swiveling side to side, bounding onward into the boundless Pacific. Just this way she starts steadily accumulating the great span of a great ocean, mile after mile after mile. And now the third chapter, Letting Go. An hour after Amelia leaves, the last visual trace of French frigate shoals falls away behind her. She makes no note of it, as you make no note of leaving sight of your house when you run an errand. She sees herself neither as heroic nor hardworking, nor does she have any other abstract concept. She has only purpose to hunt, and she is keenly aware of that. And like any animal, like us when we travel, she knows where she is relative to home. But she has no visual markers on the ever-shifting ocean. Her mental map is not like yours. Her brain contains a compass, yours doesn't, and a clock as accurate as your internal clock, which she pays more attention to. And of course she has those wings. Albatrosses usually spend 80 to 90% of their time at sea, flying day and night. The sea swells grow and roll beneath her and fall away. Amelia's flight follows them as she rises higher, her belly to the wind in her sails, then arcs into the downsweep of her flight path. Like this, she goes for hours, this undulating flight, wings set and quivering against the breeze. She's averaging 15 miles an hour, sometimes double or even triple that when the wind blows up. She seems in all ways calm and unflappable. Her broodiness is gone, and now this bird is sharply alert. She is traveling, traveling, and she is foraging. The transmitter's dialogue with the satellites will tell us where Amelia is, but we can also sketch a plausible picture of what she might be experiencing. Though Amelia has no landmarks, she has her cues. Most birds have a poor sense of smell, but the tube-nosed birds carry olfactory equipment that's among the most sensitive ever evolved. Amelia is sifting scent as she goes, so she sticks near the ocean surface like a seagoing bloodhound. And the sky is not empty of life. She isn't all that far from home as she shares the air. Terns and frigate birds occasionally cross her line of vision. She reads them skillfully, terns going and coming in a low straight line close to the water, have found a source of fish and are commuting. They're worth following. Terns 50 feet above are searching like her. They bear watching. A frigate bird flying high, tight circles, maybe watching a marlin or a school of mahi-mahi, waiting out the inevitable sprint for a flying fish. If it's late in the day, a pod of dolphins is worth following. A hunt may erupt, making fish available. Diving flocks of terns and boobies signal tuna. Tuna signal eating-sized fish, plus a promising area to linger after dark in search of squid. A line of weeds or flotsam is a good place to find floating objects with delectable flying fish eggs adhered to them. These lines mark the friction at the borders of enormous masses of water that differ in temperature, nutrient concentration, productivity, thus color, and flow rate. Living things afloat, adrift, and aloft all strongly tend to collect at these energized boundaries, both because new nutrients get injected into sparser waters and because the friction slows the current edges, concentrating minute drifting organisms that ignite the whole food chain. Such places are a bit like bustling frontier towns of countries in the sea, save that their locations are ever-changing with the winds and moving waters. When the breeze is off such a frontal zone, the scent wafts to Amelia, sometimes telling of an unseen meal miles away. What to us is trackless blue ocean is to her recognizable territory, a familiar mosaic riddled with scents and signs. As we know that in our town that the supermarket will hold food, a train will come along the tracks, children will fill the schoolyard, and a bus will appear at the stop, she likewise knows the sea's vast and changing neighborhoods and what to expect. She knows when to keep going and where patience will turn to profit. She keeps going. I'll stop there. I'm recording this about 24 hours after the 8.8 magnitude earthquake on the Kamchatka Peninsula in far eastern Russia, which caused a tsunami throughout the Pacific Ocean. It has impacted the western Hawaiian Islands, and I've been able to read that it had a 7-foot rise in sea level on Midway Island, but I don't know the result. It seems that news of these remote atolls are as hard to get as they are remote physically. It's almost like they don't exist on the internet. In 2011, the tsunami that was so devastating to Japan and other countries was devastating to the breeding seabirds on the Hawaiian Islands and on Midway and the areas that we're reading about. There's plenty to read about that online. There's a Friends of Midway Island that has a newsletter that stopped in 2018, but there's a lot of information there about the tsunami back in 2011. Almost all the albatross chicks were killed by that tsunami. These areas are so close to sea level. The adult birds are able to survive this kind of an event because they're able to fly and their chicks are stuck. I was just reading up on the Birds of the World, the Cornell website, that has great detail about all the breeding birds in the world on the Laysan albatross. I've been reading up to find the pertinent facts about breeding timing. It says that the eggs are laid from mid-November to mid-December at Midway, and it says that the eggs hatch from mid-January to mid-February, and that the chicks fledge around mid-July. So let's keep our fingers crossed that a lot of the chicks fledged before this event on the 29th of July. This is Maggie Jones. I've been reading from Eye of the Albatross, Visions of Hope and Survival by Carl Safina. Thank you for listening.